The remarkable true story of Mary Bowser, a freed slave who became a Union spy right inside the Confederate White House. That's Lois Levine.
Slavery is the perfect training for a spy, because when you are a slave, your survival and the survival of your family and the survival of your community depends on you living a double life.
That's Lois Levine. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser, and the powerful relationship between Louisa May Alcott and her mother.
I realized that there was this untold story, that these two women really were each other's partner in the world. It illuminates Louisa's work. It also illuminates her life. It explains probably why she didn't marry, why she never really left her first family, because she had to support her mother.
That's Eve LaPlante. We talk with her about her terrific new book, Marmee and Louisa. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're coming to the end of Women's History Month, following hard on the heels of Black History Month. A new novel based on the remarkable true story of Mary Bowser is a fitting way to mark both. Bowser was freed as a young girl by the abolitionist daughter of her owners, given an education in Philadelphia, and then returned to the South to become a spy for the Union Army during the Civil War. This incredible story is fictionalized in the new novel The Secrets of Mary Bowser. Author Lois Levine weaves history and speculation into a fascinating narrative exploring slavery, the Civil War, and the relationship between two remarkable and courageous women, Mary Bowser and the woman who freed her, Bette Van Leeuw. Levine has taught English literature at UCLA and Reed College. She's a regular contributor to Disunion, the New York Times series about the Civil War. Lois Levine, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It is a pleasure to talk to you.
Now, you tell the story of a real person, a woman who was born into slavery in Virginia, then was freed, and ended up as a spy for the Union side, posing as a slave in the Confederate White House. I mean, what an amazing story. First of all, how did you find out about this?
Well, you know, I call myself an accidental novelist. I was supposed to be an English professor and write about other people's books and poems. And as I was finishing my dissertation, which was about race in American literature, I read a book of women's history, and there were, you know, maybe a 300-page book, and maybe three paragraphs of those were about Mary Bowser. And it just floored me. The idea, first of all, that I had never heard of her, and then the idea of both what it would be like as an educated free woman to walk back into slavery. And of course, we know how the Civil War ends. We know that slavery ends, but nobody at the time did. So what was it like to make that choice? That was one of the things I wanted to explore in the book. Another thing that I wanted to explore in the book was the relationship between Mary Bowser and Bette Van Leeuw. So Bowser was born into slavery, and she was owned by the Van Leeuw family. Bette Van Leeuw was the daughter in that family. She was what, you know, they would politely call headstrong, and you can imagine what they were saying behind closed doors about her. And she was the one who freed Mary and sent her north to be educated. And then they worked together in this spying. And again, that's the historical fact, but I couldn't help but wonder what would it be like to have this evolving relationship on either side, these two women doing something completely courageous, certainly completely illegal. They were executing spies in Richmond during the Civil War, so either one of them could have been put to death. And how did they figure out the relationship they were going to have with each other? At one point in the novel, Mary says that she wasn't really family, she wasn't really friend. Like, she, you know, that there's some bond between them that really we don't have words to define, but that becomes incredibly important to both of them as the novel unfolds.
And what an amazing bond that is, one that really was devoted to a higher purpose. You know, as you said, Bette Van Leeuw was the one basically who freed Mary and her parents. How did that come about?
Well, this is one of those places where very few facts are known about Mary Bowser. Much more is known about Bette Van Leeuw. So I got to invent a great deal. And I invent the specifics of Mary's family. So I'll answer your questions in terms of what happens in the novel, because we don't really know what happens in real life. But one of the things that I wanted to get readers to understand, because again, I come from an academic background and I know a lot about this history, is that, of course, anybody who was enslaved wanted their freedom. But often getting your freedom meant giving something else up, that freedom always came at a cost. So when I started researching the novel, I learned that although there was a substantial free Black population in Virginia, anybody who was Black and was enslaved and was newly freed would automatically be re-enslaved if they stayed in the state for more than a year, because they didn't want this Black population to grow and have more free Blacks in the state of Virginia. So I thought, well, this is really fascinating. What would that mean if you were in Mary's position? What would it be like to get your freedom but know that you had to leave your family, your community, the only home that you've ever known, and go someplace completely alien to you? And of course, there's no phone, there's no email, there's no Facebook. You're really losing contact with the only world that you've ever known. So in the novel, the way that I set that up is to have Mary and her mother be owned by the Van Loos, and they own other slaves as well. And Mary's father is owned by somebody else. So that although Bette can give Mary and her mother their freedom, she can't give Mary's father his freedom. And that's one of the first crises in Mary's life, is what's going to happen? How will they choose between her father and her freedom?
Now, how much is known about Mary Bowser? You said you came across three paragraphs, and of course you had to invent a lot of this book. So say first, you know, how much is known, and what did you do to be able to create such a vivid and believable character?
When I started, I only knew a few facts. As it turns out, Mary Bowser was baptized and married in St. John's Church in Richmond. And if anybody has ever been to Richmond, Virginia, you'll know that Churchill is the fanciest neighborhood, and it is named for St. John's Church. And that's the church where, during the Revolutionary War, Patrick Henry gave the famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. So it's a really important church. But it was a white church, and it was extremely rare for any Black person to be baptized or married there. And even other Van Loo slaves were not baptized or married there. So I wanted to keep that real. And for those who've read the book, you'll know that there are really some important scenes of Mary, the day that she gets married, and then a flashback to her remembering being baptized there. So things like that I tried to stay close to. But there really wasn't very much information, especially about her childhood in Virginia. And so that was a lot of inventing. And for me, really a lot of the fun of writing the book was getting to understand this place. And this is a novel about slavery that doesn't have a single plantation in it, because Richmond was urban and industrialized, and the experience of being enslaved there was very different than what we usually think of when we think about slavery in America. So I did an awful lot of research, both reading other historians' work. I did travel to Richmond and spend some time in the city, but mostly trying to get the characters to be real and believable. You know, Mary's because I get to invent her family, I invent that Mary's mother is from New York. Many people don't realize that there was slavery in New York until well into the 19th century, but her father is from Virginia, so that you get this sense of the cadence of their voices or the way that they react to things. I mean, her mother is really a New Yorker and her father is really a Virginian. And I wanted to do that in part. Well, you always want your characters to be individuals, but I think especially when you're writing about slaves, that you want to show, I mean, slavery is supposed to deny humanity, and you want to show not that just people are human, but that they're individual, that slaves weren't one big category, but people were very different in how they dealt with the challenge, not only of your own survival under slavery, but imagining what it would be like to try and raise a child when you have literally no legal right to protect that child. So getting those characters right was incredibly important to me.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And, you know, the relationship between her parents, who, you know, had a relationship, had a marriage. Her father is portrayed as not only a skilled blacksmith, but in fact, the manager of, the kind of the foreman of the blacksmith firm that he works for. He's a skilled African-American. Her mother is someone who is, you know, also very powerfully drawn, as well as Mary. As you were in imagining her parents, what were some of the things that motivated you to portray them the way you did?
Well, some of it, again, was that process of discovery in my research. As it turned out, there were a lot of slaves, especially male slaves, who were in Richmond, who were skilled laborers because it's a city. So that's the kind of work you need. So some of it was just trying to show readers a side of the Black community that they might not be aware of, but also to make people feel like they could identify with this story. I chose to write the book in first person because I wanted Mary, the real Mary Bowser's voice has been lost to history, but I wanted to give a voice to this Mary to sort of honor that real Mary. Because the book is in first person, when anybody reads it, they're experiencing the Civil War, the period before the Civil War as well, through Mary's eyes. So they're in that position of being female and Black and fairly young, and that's the way that you identify. I'm asking them to step into a contentious and a dangerous time in America's past and to experience it through the eyes and the senses of somebody who was incredibly courageous, but also incredibly vulnerable in that place and time.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lois Levine about her novel, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. It reimagines the true story of a real woman who was born into slavery in Virginia and who ended up posing as a slave in the Confederate White House as part of a spy ring for the Union against the Confederacy. I went online and I saw your photo. You look like you're not an African American. You look like you're white. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
And you explore, I think, in this relationship between Mary Bowser and Bette Van Leeuw, who, you know, was instrumental in freeing her and in getting her involved in the abolition movement and as a spy. You explore some of the more prickly aspects of the relationship between them as former master and slave, as Black and white, you know, kind of all those issues that have to do around privilege and how people who have privilege, you know, may have a pretty difficult way to understand what it's like to be on the other side of that. What was this relationship between them?
Well, I think they each have initial ideas of who the other is, and those ideas are not, they don't involve animosity or antagonism. That has always been, as far as Mary can remember, opposed to slavery, although she doesn't always understand the ramifications of the choices that she makes. But that they have to kind of learn that their assumptions about each one about the other are not always accurate. And they also ultimately have to show each other how important each one is to the other. By the end of the book, Mary is in her mid-20s. So she is fully an adult, although her entire life has been spent in somehow in relationship to Bette. And it is a really important relationship for both of them. And I think that there are other moments in the book and other relationships in the book, relationships between Black characters and white characters that also take on some of this. But it's particularly intense between the two of them. And there's a moment where Mary realizes about Bette. She says, you know, she wanted to see me free and educated when the only other people who wanted that for me were my parents. On the one hand, she sees this immense value in Mary. And on the other hand, she is somebody who lives with a huge amount of privilege, and she can't even understand that. So when Mary, after living free in the North and being educated, returns to the South, Mary realizes that even before they start spying, that she has to present herself as though she's still a slave. Because remember, it's illegal for free Blacks to come back into the state of Virginia. So she's prepared to take on that role even before she has to spy, just because they know that war is coming and she wants to be able to be in Richmond to help along the war effort, whatever will transpire. And Bette is very uncomfortable with that. And Mary says, well, you know, you still expect to call me to call you Miss Bette. In this whole conversation, she's saying, well, Mary, I really don't think. And Mary is saying, well, Miss Bette, I really think. And finally, Mary says, you know, you still expect me to call you Miss Bette. And Bette doesn't answer. But it is her non-answer is the closest she can get to admitting that she's wrong. That is to say, she's grown up in a world in which Black people respond to white people, even if they were not your owners in a particular way. You always said Miss or Mr., or if even if it wasn't master or mistress, you, and yet Blacks were always called by their first name. So just each one of them kind of having to shake out of their expectations of their relationship. And again, having to realize more and more what it means to rely one on the other over the course of the book. And in terms of my coming to write this, you know, I had really been teaching and thinking a lot about race in America for a long time before I started writing this book. And part of that was that I, like many young women, went off to college and read and learned feminist theory and feminist criticism and felt really empowered talking about gender. But there were a lot of Black feminists, Audre Lorde and bell hooks, June Jordan, who were saying in their own writing and their own work, you know, we can't just talk about gender, that gender and race and class always work together. And I think that example of Bette expecting to be called Miss Bette is about race, and it's also about class and how inseparable those things are. And so that really inspired me to specialize in studying African-American literature. I got to read, and I get to read and to teach fantastic literature by Black writers. And so I feel like this book owes a lot to those writers. It owes a lot to the professors who taught me and to being ready to take that leap. I think that in some ways, it would have been a safer move for me to make to write this book from Bette Van Leeuw's point of view. Safer for me because although I've never lived, you know, I don't live in Virginia, I've never lived in a slaveholding society. You know, there are many differences between me and Bette. People expect that when you're crossing the race line to write, that that's a bigger leap than writing somebody from a different religion or, you know, other kinds of differences.
We're talking with Lois Levine about her book, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. You know, another point that I think maybe perhaps I understand now why the role of African Americans in the abolition movement has been so ignored, I think. I mean, you mentioned the movie Lincoln. You know, I think there's like a cameo appearance, you know, of the African-Americans who were involved in the struggle. Their role is really not talked about at all. Talk a little bit more about the role of African-Americans and African-American women in the abolition movement, maybe beyond Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, who I think are the only ones that we have heard of.
Sure. And, you know, one of my decisions in how to write the novel was not only to give Mary's childhood in Richmond, but also the years that she spends living in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia did have a vibrant Black community. They weren't all wealthy, and some of them were living, you know, in dire poverty, but there was a Black community there that was very politically active around abolition and other issues. And that you're right, Lincoln didn't wake up one day an abolitionist, that came from a long push by Black activists and white activists working sometimes together and sometimes at loggerheads about what to do about a system that was enslaving millions and millions and millions of people in our country. So there are many characters in this novel, Sarah Maps Douglas, Grace Maps, Margaretta Fortin, Robert Purvis, David Bastille Bowser, who are real people. And it was a pleasure for me to kind of weave their stories into this novel and give people a sense of how rich that anti-slavery community was, but also how divided they might be. So, for example, one of the things that happens over the course of the novel is John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Brown is an abolitionist. And he was very extreme, and he tried to seize a federal arsenal. This is long before the Civil War. Tried to seize a federal arsenal in Virginia and take the munitions out and arm slaves for a wide-scale slave rebellion. Doesn't work out. And there's a lot in the novel about people in the North responding to this. So Mary's living in Philadelphia and realizing that some of the people who are involved in the anti-slavery movement, their responses to John Brown's raid or their responses to the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin are very different than her own, and that there's not one abolitionist position to have, but also that the work that as you said, women are doing is in some ways very powerful. I think that obviously Harriet Tubman is part of the Underground Railroad is a name that we know, but that there were many ways that people challenged slavery, and trying to illustrate those without, you know, without this reading like a history book, but reading like the story of one incredible character, but letting her encounter so many of, whether they're real or fictional characters, but characters who are based in that long history of anti-slavery work, which really starts, you know, from before this country is founded. One of the people, Mary, is a book junkie. She's an autobiographical character in that sense. I love to read, and she loves to read. And so at the back of the novel, I have Mary's reading list. It's all of the things that she mentions reading over the course of the novel. And one of the people that she reads is Phyllis Wheatley, who was a slave and who published her first book of poetry while she was still a child, when she was a teenager, and while she was still enslaved. And that's kind of a mind-blowing fact right there. But the way that Wheatley writes about slavery is a very complicated message, because she wants to critique an institution that she is also subject to. So, you know, letting people know about Phyllis Wheatley, about Frances Harper, who another person on Mary's reading list, just to kind of build this sense of, yeah, the Emancipation Proclamation was decades and decades and decades in the making. And as you said, it is a history that we're still learning. Sometimes it's a history that we're still learning. I'm still doing research on Mary Bowser and still finding documents about Mary Bowser that no historians have known about. But sometimes it's a history that we're still learning just because we like a great man story.
We haven't yet talked about, you know, maybe the most amazing part of the story, and that was Mary Bowser's work as a spy right within the Confederate White House, in the home of Jefferson Davis. How did she accomplish this?
Well, I like to say she wasn't above suspicion so much as she was kind of below suspicion. That as a Black, and particularly a female, being in a domestic space, the idea that you were there was not surprising. I mean, there were slave owners who slept with slaves in their room. So whatever you were doing with your husband or wife happened with a slave in the same room.
But she was pretending to be a slave.
Yes. Yeah. And so I was talking to somebody who had read the book who said, I just can't believe that they would never suspect that she did it. And we were in a room full of people. And I said, well, okay, of all the women who are in the room right now, how many of you have ever been someplace where somebody assumed you aren't as smart as you are because you're female? And all the women had stories to tell. So I think that that idea of knowing that you've been written off is something that we can still relate to, obviously not on this scale, but in some ways, this is what was most amazing to me. I guess there are two parts. One is that the system of slavery denied the humanity of African Americans by saying they were not capable of intelligence, the same way that you could buy and sell a horse or an ox, you could buy or sell a Black because they weren't really human. They weren't really capable of intelligence. And by working within that stereotype, Mary Bowser proved the importance of Black intelligence because she became an intelligence agent, an actual spy. So I like that idea. And I also have come to realize that in some ways slavery is the perfect training for a spy. Because when you are a slave, your survival and the survival of your family and the survival of your community depends on you living a double life. You are told you are one thing when you know you are something else. You are told that there are things that you can't do that you are always trying to do. You are told that there are things you must do that you're always trying to not do. You are always living surreptitiously. So, of course, a slave would understand how to be a spy, that even long before Mary becomes a spy, even when she's a child and she's in slavery, the slaves in the family know that information is their most valuable commodity, that when the slave master dies, you want to know what his will says, because that will is going to tell you whether you and your children are going to get to live together anymore or not. You need information, and how do you get information? So using that kind of slavery as training for a spy, but also using the way that the assumptions of the slave owners could be used against them. How do you fight a system that is so dominating, that has you in such complete subordination? Well, you have to figure out how to do that within that system. And so playing to the expectations that slaves were stupid, that slaves were illiterate, that slaves had no connection outside of their immediate world, Mary was able to have access to information, and she was able to be part of a very sophisticated network to share that information out outside of the Confederacy to the Union generals and the Union military leadership.
Wow. It's an amazing story. So what have you found that others have not, and what happened to Mary Bowser?
Well, Mary is, and this is, of course, beyond the scope of the novel, so this is, now we're switching into history mode. I had heard that after the war, Mary gave at least one lecture in New York, and I was able to find documentation of her giving a lecture in Manhattan in September of 1865, so a few months after the war ends, using the name Richmonia Richards. Why would she use a pseudonym even after the war is over? Well, I think it comes back to that living surreptitiously, right? She is still aware of how dangerous the South is, and to have exposed herself by name and associated herself with aspiring would have been very dangerous. So I knew about that document for a while. I discovered that she, or I had heard from somebody that she actually happened to accidentally meet Harriet Beecher Stowe about 2 years after the Civil War ended, which is the sort of thing you can't put in your novel because nobody would believe it. But I was able to find in Harriet Beecher Stowe was traveling with her brother, and in her brother's journal, he talks about meeting Mary, and he describes her, and he describes a conversation that they have where she talks about herself. And then I discovered that there was another instance in which she gave a talk in New York. So she gives a talk in Manhattan saying that she's Richmonia Richards. A week later, she gave a talk in Brooklyn using a completely different pseudonym, Richmonia St. Pierre. So she was making it very hard for historians to try and find her. I mean, a different pseudonym every time you move from one borough to another is a very complicated thing for a historian to deal with. And we know about those two talks that she gave because reporters were there and they wrote articles about what she said. But it's inconsistent what she says from one talk to another and then what she says when she meets Harriet Beecher Stowe and Charles Beecher. She gives different biographical facts. She makes different claims about herself, which in some ways made me feel great as a novelist. Like, oh, well, she was making up her own story and I'm making up her story, so I can't be any worse off than she is. But I think really does reflect the fact that she is conscious of how dangerous it is still in the South. And the very last documents that I have about her, she taught in a school in Georgia, what were called the Freedmen Schools, which are schools for newly freed African Americans. She was in a very small town in Georgia. She was the only teacher there. So she created the school and she ran it for a few months. And she wrote letters to the superintendent of education for Georgia. And in her letters, she says, "This is a dangerous place. I have been a spy for the federal government. And I can tell you, I know how to read people. And this is a dangerous place to be." So really interesting documents from a historian's perspective, because she's using the authority of having been an intelligence agent to make this case for how dangerous the post-Civil War South remains for African Americans. And I like that the book ends as the war ends and everything is very cheery, and it's a very upbeat ending, but we know the reality of the Ku Klux Klan and the reign of terror in the South for decades and decades and decades. And clearly the historic Mary Bowser was very much aware of that. And not long after writing those letters, she ends up leaving the school and leaving the South. And at least one of the letters that she writes indicates that she may have left the country entirely. So I'm still looking for her, but she becomes harder and harder to find. And I think that's not just about this one individual, but thinking sort of more symbolically or metaphorically that we would like the Civil War to have resolved the question of slavery and thus the question of race in America. But it opens up all sorts of new questions about race that I think we're still struggling with today.
Wow, it's a terrific book, The Secrets of Mary Bowser, an amazing history and an amazing work of fiction as well. I want to thank you so much, Lois Levine, for talking with us here about your book.
You're quite welcome, Francesca. It was great.
You can read an excerpt from The Secrets of Mary Bowser at writersvoice.net. Next up, we explore the powerful connection between a famous daughter and her mother, Louisa and Abigail May Alcott. Stay tuned after the break.
No more. No more. No more. No more.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Like millions of other girls before me, I loved reading Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. I identified with Jo March and thrilled to her struggle to transcend the restrictive notions about women in 19th century America, or 20th century America for that matter. What I didn't know was how much Louisa May Alcott's own family was a model for her classic bestseller, sometimes in an idealized version as with the character of Jo and her sister's father, but the portrayal of the girl's mother, Marmee, was truer than anyone knew, until now. That's because Eve LaPlante's new book, Marmee and Louisa, reveals for the first time the intense and close personal relationship between Louisa May Alcott and her mother, Abigail. And yes, she did call her mother Marmee. Scholars and authors have long focused on Alcott's relationship to her father, Bronson Alcott, almost certainly because plenty of documentary evidence of that relationship survives. Many of her mother's papers were destroyed after her death. But LaPlante is Abigail May Alcott's great-niece. A cache of previously unexamined family papers led her to a new understanding of the mother-daughter bond between Abigail and Louisa, and the profound influence of that relationship on Louisa's work and her ideas about women's rights and slavery. Eve LaPlante's fascinating dual biography breaks new ground in a gripping and sensitive narrative that reveals not only the past, but how the struggles of yesterday's women continue to hold much relevance to our lives today. Eve LaPlante is the author of several other nonfiction books, including American Jezebel and Salem Witch Judge. Marmee and Louisa is being released with a companion volume of Abigail May Alcott's writing, My Heart is Boundless. Well, Eve LaPlante, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
This was just a wonderful read, Marmee and Louisa, the untold story of Louisa May Alcott and her mother. You know, I interviewed Susan Cheever several years ago, who wrote a book very much centered on Louisa May Alcott and her father. And when you say that this was the untold story, it was very much something that really kind of went by the wayside in the other one. You are the great-niece of Abigail May Alcott, the mother of Louisa May, and so you're a cousin to Louisa May Alcott. How did you start to find out about this story, this very close relationship between Louisa and her mom?
Well, I knew growing up that my great-aunt Charlotte, who kept a family tree, referred to Louisa as Cousin Louisa. I didn't really understand why. I really loved, you know, Louisa's novels for children, Little Women, Jack and Jill, etc., when I was a girl. And I eventually grew up and started, I was a journalist and an author, and I ended up going back to my Aunt Charlotte's family tree to figure out why she would talk about our ancestors so much, because I hadn't really appreciated it as a kid, and realizing that, you know, she was very proud of her great-grandfather, Sam Joe May, who was Abigail's brother, and learning a bit about him. And then I found some papers in my mother's attic in a trunk that had belonged to Aunt Charlotte. And I had always shied away from the Alcotts because I thought, oh, well, you know, there's nothing new to say. But as I pursued the May family and Abigail's side of the family and Louisa's relationship with her mother, whom she did call Marmee, I realized that there was this untold story, as you said, and that these two women really were each other's partner in the world, and that that was a fascinating and in some ways, you know, it illuminates Louisa's work. It also illuminates her life. It explains why she didn't marry, why she never really left her first family, because she had to support her mother. You know, and so much about her work is explained by this important relationship. And then the final kind of amazing discovery I didn't make until I was actually already writing Marmee and Louisa, and that is that there are all these hundreds and hundreds of pages of Abigail's writings that have been sort of hiding in plain sight in archives mostly, although I did find a couple of new letters in a farmhouse in western Maine where Abigail had lived in 1848. And there were all these papers that were really overlooked because everyone thought that Abigail May Alcott's papers were all burned by her husband and daughter after she died. So it was really a series of these discoveries that led to both Marmee and Louisa and its companion book, My Heart is Boundless.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, where does that title come from?
My Heart is Boundless?
Yes.
Well, it comes from Abigail's writings herself. Abigail described herself in a letter to her brother, Samuel Joseph, as having a boundless heart. So we looked only among her writings to find the title. And she was a very extremely interested in improving the world and very kind of an expansive person, very ambitious and proud and had quite a bit of wit, but also deeply frustrated by her life and the limitations she experienced.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But first, tell us more about Abigail, the life that she was born into.
Well, she was born into she was born into an established Boston family. She was the niece of Dorothy Quincy, who was the wife of John Hancock. And she knew her Aunt Q, Dorothy Quincy, very well. And she grew up among, you know, the noted ministers and academics and merchants of early 19th century Boston. And she really rejected the role that she was expected to assume as a young girl and a young woman in her society, which was as a wife and mother. And her sister, she had three older sisters, just like the youngest daughter in the March story in Little Women. And then they all married and they all had children. And actually, they all died relatively young before they were in their mid-30s. And she didn't want that path. She wanted to be a writer or a teacher. And Abigail was, she also modeled herself on her older brother, Samuel Joseph, who got a, you know, what was the classical man's education for a son of the well-to-do, which was he went to Harvard and Harvard Divinity School, and he got a pulpit. He became a minister. So she learned about the world and philosophy from him, tried to sort of copy his education at home, and then wanted to do something, and then in her late 20s, which was very old at the time for a woman to marry, she met Bronson Alcott, who was different from every other man she'd met. He seemed free of all these constraints of her rigid society, and he was a school teacher interested in early education, and she married him to her father's consternation, because he really wasn't a traditional spouse, and he actually couldn't make a living, and he was terribly in debt throughout all of his life, including during their engagement. So, and I think she had high hopes that they would have a different kind of marriage. And what happened was she was pregnant for the next 10 years and had four daughters, as you know, and a number of miscarriages. And then, you know, he could never make a living. So they lived in poverty and they were homeless. And that was a very difficult life that I think anyone who's ever been homeless and hungry could appreciate.
And he just, I have to say, he doesn't come off very well in this book. He seems like an impossible egotist.
Yeah, you know, some people get very angry at Bronson. And certainly, if you were married to him, you would get angry at him because he, you know, he had these higher philosophical goals and he didn't feel it was important to support his family or bring food or provide a stable home for his children. But I also feel some compassion for him because I think it was very difficult to be him and to feel that he had this great gift that the world would not or could not appreciate. You know, he's in some ways a character that one can empathize with, but I know a lot of people get very angry with Bronson. Mm. And I didn't set out to attack him at all. I was really just trying to get inside the minds and the lives and the hearts of Abigail and Louisa.
I don't want to spend too much time on Bronson, but he did have a very advanced ideas about education, it seems, although they weren't completely original. Pestalozzi was, I guess, an inspiration for him.
Mm-hmm.
But still, they seem quite advanced for his time. First of all, say a little bit about his ideas. And was that part of the attraction that he had for Abigail? You know, was she drawn to him because of those ideas?
Oh, yes. She, when they first met and they courted for several years, she thought he was brilliant and wonderful and different from other men and freer. You know, he was interested in children and he had a much freer idea of religion than most of her peers. And I think she viewed him as sort of a way out of her rigid world where she might have a voice in the world and perhaps be able to write and teach. She always wanted to work with him and he would never allow her to serve as his assistant, which was very frustrating for her because he was hiring, you know, Elizabeth Peabody and he was hiring Margaret Fuller and various other people he worked with over the years. but he wouldn't allow Abigail to teach. Of course, she really taught the children at home. So, you know, she had her own, the four daughters that she did most of the raising of. He also was not around very much for much of the children's early lives.
And how did she raise her children? I mean, what was her method of educating them that was, of course, so important? Because they were all women, they were all girls, and they couldn't get that kind of classical Harvard education either.
Right. Yeah, and their male cousins were all going to Harvard. You know, sort of it was the family tradition. Five generations of the May family had gone to Harvard, or not the May family, but her mother's family, the Sewells. But she read a great deal to them, from novels and poetry, and I think that there was a great deal of literature just in their daily life. And she encouraged them to do art and to learn music in the home. You know, she taught them to write. And for Louisa particularly, Abigail felt that a way of expressing her intense emotions would actually make her life easier. And so Abigail frequently encouraged Louisa to write as a way to deal with her difficult emotions. So it was somewhat of a therapeutic thing that she was encouraging in her daughter, Louisa.
And it seems like you say that of all the daughters, that Louisa is most like her mom. In what way?
Well, in the superficial way that everyone thought they looked alike. And, you know, there are comments that I put throughout Marmy and Louisa, that people will meet them and, you know, say that Louisa's the image of Abigail or things like that. But I think in a more fundamental way, that they had characters that were similar. And Louisa, of all the girls, I mean, all the girls were very devoted to their parents and very loyal. I think of Louisa was the one who decided she was sort of going to save the family and become, in a sense, the absent husband and father. And even at the age of 10, she verbalized that she was going to grow up and take care of her mother, which is really sort of a tragic thing to realize that it's as so young that Louisa May Alcott had this tremendous burden, this role she had to fulfill, which was in many ways a trap for her, although it was what enabled her to write all the great books she wrote and stories at the same time. So it's complicated. But I think, you know, Abigail had wanted to write and wrote very beautiful letters, which you can read in My Heart is Boundless. And I think Louisa inherited that literary sensibility from her. Abigail was always writing little poems for the girls. Some of them are in My Heart is Boundless because she wrote them in her journals. And she was very interested in language and ideas. Abigail was a great abolitionist, well before her husband was, actually. Bronson was quite suspicious of Garrison in the beginning of the abolition movement and in the 1830s. And Abigail was on board right away. And she was also a very strong suffragist. And again, Louisa carried on with these various reforms when she became a woman.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Eve LaPlante about the book that she wrote about her cousin, Louisa May Alcott, and her great, 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 I don't know how many great aunts, Abigail May Alcott. It's called Marmy and Louisa, The Untold Story of Louisa May Alcott and Her Mother. This is just a fascinating part of the story. And it wasn't just Abigail. I mean, you mentioned her brother, Sam Joe.
Right.
He was also very active in the abolition movement. Is that right?
Yeah, he's a really fascinating character. And one thing I realized as I was working on Marmy and Louisa is that he's probably the closest real-life inspiration for Mr. March, the minister in Little Women, the father of the four girls. And the descriptions of Mr. March in Little Women are almost exactly like descriptions of Samuel Joseph May, you know, from friends and family. Samuel Joseph was, you know, as I said, he was very privileged. He had this, you know, the best education you could get as a young man in the early 19th century. And he had a pulpit. And then he became, at age 32, he heard William Lloyd Garrison speak, and he basically had almost like a conversion experience, and he became a very, very active abolitionist. He founded, with Garrison and various other men in Boston, founded the Anti-Slavery Society in 1831, and then he began basically going around New England and speaking for abolition. He would have people throw tomatoes at him and try to burn down churches he was going to talk in. He preached for abolition. He integrated the seating in his church racially in the 1830s and had to leave a church in Massachusetts. He was really a radical, but he also maintained this very conventional, traditional life as a minister. He was beloved by his community. He had a very conventional marriage. He had four kids. So at the same time he was becoming this real activist radical, he never left the sort of elegance of his and sort of traditional aspect of his background. He's a fascinating character for me.
Why is he so fascinating for you?
Well, you know, he was just somebody about whom nothing bad was ever said. Samuel Joseph May was, along with Emerson, was basically supporting the Alcotts in these years before Abigail and also Anna and Louisa went to work, and they were all struggling to make money. And Samuel Joseph was always sending them money and helping them buy fruit lands, et cetera, and getting a mortgage for fruit lands. And he found Bronson very frustrating, but he never broke with Bronson. He always hosted Bronson in his house in Syracuse, New York, and he was very kind of accepting of everyone. He was all good. You know, it's very hard to find the flaws in Samuel Joseph May. I'm still looking to see if I can find them.
And Fruitlands, of course, was the utopian community that Bronson Alcott established, although it didn't last a whole long time.
No.
So back to Abigail May Alcott, Louisa May Alcott's mother. She, as you said, got involved with abolition as well. You know, maybe you could tell us the story. There's an incident that you write about in the book of a speech at the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society where George Thompson is speaking, and a kind of riot ensues, and then Abigail, I get the sense she's not there, but she hears about it. Tell us what happened there.
I think the scene you're talking about is she's home with Anna and Louisa, and I think Louisa's about 3 years old, maybe 2.5, and they're afraid that because of the riot outside, because of Thompson, that, you know, perhaps people will start coming into their house, and she removes the portrait that she has on the wall of Thompson.
And who was he?
He was a very famous abolitionist from England, and she rushes around the house with the little girls around her and removes a painting of George Thompson from the wall, and she wrote later that Louisa then, who was a toddler, crawled under the bed where Abigail had hidden the portrait, and she told her mother that she wanted to comfort the good man who helped the poor slaves.
Yeah.
So even at 2.5, Louisa's sort of right on board with the abolitionist cause, which really was not acceptable in Boston to most Bostonians in the 1830s. The common feeling among New Englanders at the time was that perhaps colonization would solve the problem of slavery in America, but certainly it should not be ended immediately, and African Americans should not have equal rights with white people. That was the general feeling at the time. So the May family was unusual.
You also mentioned women's rights. And this, of course, there was a connection. Many of the early female abolitionists were also the women who basically founded the women's movement in this country, among them being Margaret Fuller. And Louisa May Alcott's mother also was involved with some of this. She had a petition to the Massachusetts legislature. Talk about her involvement with the women's movement.
Yeah, well, early on, women were very interested in ending slavery. I mean, as a group, I think white women identified with slaves because they felt that in many ways they were enslaved by their very rigid limitations in the society in the early 19th century. So what happened was the male abolitionists, some of the men didn't want women to be agents of the anti-slavery society. They didn't want them speaking in public because it was considered inappropriate. So the abolition movement actually split in the 1830s, and there was the group that Sam Joe May and Garrison and others were in that allowed women in to participate equally, and then there was another society, anti-slavery, that didn't. And so basically these two groups worked together, the abolitionists and the women's rights activists, through these 30 years prior to the Civil War. And at the end of the Civil War, some of the abolitionists some of the men basically felt they were done because slavery had been ended with the, you know, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But a lot of women were frustrated because women still didn't have the vote. They didn't have equal rights as citizens. So various women were, you know, creating the equal rights movement. And Abigail wrote two different petitions requesting suffrage for women as an adult. And people like her brother and Garrison had signed these petitions, and she never got anywhere with the legislature of Massachusetts. And she called it taxation without representation, just as the Patriots had during the Revolutionary War, because women were being taxed. Wealthy women like Louisa May Alcott were paying a lot of tax to Massachusetts, but they still weren't allowed to vote. So this was a passion of hers. And actually, none of the Alcotts lived to see female suffrage, because that was several decades after they died.
Now, Louisa May Alcott's mother, Abigail May Alcott, was also engaged with the problems of the poor. In fact,
yes.
In a way, she could have been the first social worker.
Yes, it was the first generation of social workers in America. It was in the late 1840s in Boston, and she was working to find jobs and housing and clothes and homes for the poor of Boston, like a community organizer today. And she did that for about 4 years. She was supported by various churches and societies, and she found it exhausting, as you could imagine. She was now in her early 50s and very tired and growing overweight and ultimately had to stop. She also ran an employment agency in Boston during that same period.
And then she got involved with the water cure up in Maine. As you said before, you found some of her writings up there.
Yes.
What was that?
Yeah, the water cure was this amazing thing at this time. It was imported from Europe from some German doctors, and it was the hottest thing around among the intelligentsia. You would go to a spa in a place like Bennington, Vermont, or Waterford, Maine, beautiful country place, and you would basically soak in water, have cold towels, you know, with water in them wrapped around you, take long walks, drink a lot of water, have a much more rudimentary diet than normal. And for a lot of women, as well as men, but I think women particularly, the idea that they could take off all these corsets and elaborate skirts that they were wearing and just be quiet, almost like in a sauna or something, or a spa, was very relaxing and helpful. So it was really a very big deal for the people that could afford to go away from their family, often for months to stay at these places. And Abigail, in desperation in 1848, because she just knew her husband was never going to be able to support the family, if it had been true for 20 years, she went up to Waterford, Maine with her youngest daughter, who was then 7, Abby May, and she worked at a water cure spot as basically it was called a matron. She basically cooked the meals, cleaned the beds, you know, dusted and took care of the whole thing and ran the show. And she did not approve of the management of this water cure spa in Western Maine, so she actually left after 6 weeks, and she didn't even have money to take the coach home. So she actually had to borrow $5 from a friend, and it is in the home of that friend that I found, a man who lives there now. He had these letters, and I happened to call him up and learn about them. And there were two letters that Abigail had written to her friend who loaned her $5. And they're still in that same house where they were mailed in 1848.
Amazing. We're talking with Eve LaPlante about her book, Marmee and Louisa, The Untold Story of Louisa May Alcott and Her Mother. You know, in that relationship, you say someplace in the introduction of the book, actually, I have it right here, you say that it was clear that this mother and daughter shared a profound intimacy that had light and dark facets, in which a fierce commitment to female independence coexisted with a mutual dependency. Could you say a little bit more about that latter half, the mutual dependency? What was the dark aspects of this relationship?
Well, I think it arose from the fact that Abigail and Bronson, Louisa's parents, they were so poorly matched, and they had such a difficult marriage, and which is true for many people, but because he was unable to do what he was supposed to do as a man, which was support his family, he really couldn't do that. They were impoverished, so whatever emotional struggles were, you know, increased by the actual physical lack of resources, as they particularly they had all these children. She had 8 or 9 pregnancies during the 1830s. So she was trying to raise little kids and also support herself in a time when a woman really wasn't supposed to work outside the home. So there was that unhappy marriage, and then Louisa, a very sensitive, gifted child, seeing her mother's struggle, ended up feeling she should become the provider. And while her sisters also were very supportive and loyal, they didn't feel bonded, I think, in the same way to their mother, to Marmee. And for Louisa, it was great in a sense because she found her way from trying teaching and being a maid and doing laundry and as a seamstress, she found her way to writing, and she ended up being able to make not only a good living, but, you know, became a best-selling author and was very successful. So she succeeded in accomplishing this goal of supporting her mother, but she also didn't ever succeed in separating from her mother and finding her own family. Now, there's another factor we haven't mentioned, which is that Louisa was chronically ill from her 30s, and doctors now believe she had lupus or another autoimmune disorder. It was sort of set off by her treatment for typhoid fever during the Civil War when she was a nurse in Washington, D.C., but that treatment could not have caused the 20 years of struggle she had after the war, and they think now that it was probably, as I said, an autoimmune disorder, and perhaps she never would have felt like she could go out in the world and create her own family because of her illness. And she was also working very hard all the time to write. But there's always an underside to these connections between family members when the child is unable to get out. And I think that's a sad thing, that Louisa couldn't find her own way in the world without her mother. Mm. She didn't live much past either. Well, she didn't live very long past her father, and she only lived 9 years past her mother.
Now, she is not, Louisa May Alcott is not the only illustrious ancestor that you have in your family, Eve LaPlante. It's incredible. One of your ancestors was Anne Hutchinson. You wrote a book about her, American Jezebel. Another was the judge at the Salem witch trial, who then had a kind of epiphany and became a much more liberal person.
He became a feminist.
He became a feminist. Yep. What was his name?
His name was Samuel Sewall, and 4 years after the Salem witch hunt of 1692, he realized that he had done a terrible thing, and he actually had the whole province of New England repent in 1697, and he publicly apologized for his actions, which really no other judge ever did. Nobody else recanted or turned away, none of the powerful men like the judges of the court. So, and then he went on to write the first anti-slavery tract that was published in America in 1700, and he wrote this early feminist tract in the early 18th century where he basically writes the first argument that women are equal to men.
Wow.
And he was quite a character. All of these people were introduced to me by my great aunt Charlotte, and as a kid I didn't really appreciate the fascinating stories, but as an adult journalist I've really enjoyed researching all of these people. In fact, I wish there were more on the family tree.
Well, the book is Marmee and Louisa, The Untold Story of Louisa May Alcott and Her Mother. We've been talking with the author, Eve LaPlante. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Francesca. I loved it.
Eve LaPlante is the author of 5 nonfiction books, including American Jezebel and Salem Witch Judge. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from her latest, Marmee and Louisa. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.